start again. One way I may help the subject discussion is that what Kant's doing when he describes the transcendental object equals X, he describes it as having a function. Right? That's the crux of the entire argument. He says the object is viewed as that which prevents. So notice, it does a job, it does a logical task. Right? So the object is viewed as that which prevents our modes of knowledge from being haphazard or arbitrary, and which determines them a priori in some definite fashion. For insofar as they relate to an object, they must necessarily agree with one another, that is, must possess the unity which constitutes the concept of an object. So, in Locke, the X is real essence, or substance, but also the, and I should say that Kant misread Locke. I won't go through his misreading of Locke. He read Locke, as most people did, as an empiricist. Locke is not an empiricist. He's a scientific realist. But that's a long, complicated story. I'm not going to read that. So the substance is the underlying support, the invisible support, which confers unity for Locke, right, on the object. But notice it has a function. And Kant says, well, if the idea of the transcendental object equals X is now given a functional description, namely, is that which prevents our modes of knowledge from being haphazard or arbitrary, and introduces unity into the object, then his first question is, well, what kind of unity does it introduce? Well, the only kind of unity we can be interested in is the unity of something that for us counts as an object of a judgment. That is, the only kind of unity that matters is the unity of a judgmental object. So in saying that, he can then say that if the function is introducing unity, but since this X is already outside representation, right? That's the famous Lockean veil of perception. Right? Given its own wiggly character. That's a veil of perception. Right? And Locke says, we can't get behind it, so we can't know what underlies our ideas. And Locke said, well then, it doesn't do anything for us. How can it play its role of unification, right, if it means nothing to us, if it's outside our whole epistemic experience? So what we want is the function. And the function, namely providing unity, is provided by synthesis. So this line is the line of synthesis that introduces into our representational manifold, right, the order of the concept of an object. So, for example, allows us to say the vase is tall. Right? It's a vase, the flower.
Did you get that originally? Now the flower.
In a surrealist sort of way.
In a surrealist sort of way. I thought it was not the flower. It would make the whole thing come together. Thank you. Okay. So, the Lockean notion of transcendental object equals X is literally a notion of substance. Kant reinterprets substance as function, that is, as what introduces unity into the manifold of intuition, and then says that function is carried on by the unity of synthesis. That is, our manner of ordering and grasping the intuitive manifold. That is what provides the requisite form of unity. Well, I haven't got necessity out of this yet. To come, but he's going to try to argue that this is a necessary unity of apperception, a necessary unity. That help? Is it still utterly puzzling? Just squinting their eyes. As if looking at the picture harder is going to help. Okay. Let me press on, and maybe this will kind of come back and make sense. The famously, the question of a transcendental deduction is a question, what is a transcendental deduction and how does it work? And there's a huge debate about this. And I'm going to be very brief. We know that transcendental object equals X, and there I thought I was making everything so simple. Kant's account is, right, transcendental deductions would be the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience. Obviously, the question is, what does Kant mean by experience? And the debates about the nature of the transcendental deduction are really debates about what he means by experience in that phrase. And he can be thought to mean one of two things. He can either mean by experience mere consciousness, or he can mean ordinary knowledge. How you interpret experience will therefore determine how you interpret the ambition of the transcendental deduction as a totality. If you see that what Kant wants to begin with is something very, very minimal, I am conscious. Then you're going to think that the ambition of the deduction is anti-skeptical. That is, you're going to think that what Kant wants to do is to produce an argument so that the necessary conditions for the possibility of self-consciousness are that experience must be of a realm of items which are objective in the sense that they can be distinguished from myself and my inner states. So one reading of the Transcendental Deduction is that it's this wildly ambitious project of deducing from the mere fact of what's called the Cartesian starting point, I am self-aware, to the conclusion that as a necessary condition for this to be the case, I must be aware of myself as having objective knowledge of things that can be distinguished from me and from my inner states, of which my inner states are but one path through an objective realm. And this is the strong, progressive, called the progressive interpretation of the deduction. And it's what most of the literature really thinks Kant's doing. The alternative interpretation begins from the fact of empirical knowledge. I have common sense knowledge, the bottle is blue, the table is gray, etc. And from this, I deduce the necessary conditions for the possibility of this is the objective validity of the categories. And this account is called the regressive interpretation of transcendental deductions. I consider the attempt to read Kant as providing a progressive reading, a deep anti-skeptical argument, to be completely mistaken. And I think it's mistaken, I think it's mistaken textually. We'll come to that as we go along. And I also happen to think that the idea of anti-skeptical arguments are mistaken. That is, I think that if you begin with a skeptical premise, you're just going to end up with a skeptical conclusion. That, so to speak, you can't, as it were, demonstrate from a weak premise the possibility, the necessity of knowledge of the world. Kant never, as far as I can make out, has anything like an anti-skeptical argument. The closest he comes is in a passage called The Refutation of Idealism, which he says is not an anti-skeptical argument, but the refutation of a certain version of idealism, in which the inner is primary over the outer, and he tries to defeat that claim. Almost all the literature, including all the commentaries you have, read Kant as having a progressive anti-skeptical argument. That's not the way I'm going to teach it. So if you're interested in that, read all those wonderful books. I'm going to suggest that all we want is this. That is, what we want to show is from the premise, totally anti itself, a non-skeptical premise, we have knowledge of the world.
suggesting that what we show is the categories are objectively valid. Now, I consider that an immensely itself ambitious thing, but in the literature they speak of it as, oh, well, you know, if you're going to help yourself to knowledge of the world, why bother? As if the only thing worthwhile doing in philosophy is defeating skepticism. And this is, you know, a debate within philosophy. There are philosophers who, you know, withdraw from that game, that sport, think that there are other types of theories. So I'm going to be going with the problem of regressive interpretation. The fullest defenses of it, I guess, can be found in Carl Americh's books, Interpreting Kant's Critiques. It's Americh who really has a hegemonic control over this little domain of argumentation and, you know, owns the regressive argument. But there are other versions of it. I like Mikan and Brooks, Andrew Brooks' book, Kant and Mind. And in the book by Dickerson also is a version of the regressive argument. And indeed, as I go along, I even have a weaker argument than the regressive argument. I hate straw. Okay. So, the A deduction is often said to be, especially the first half of it, a subjective deduction as opposed to an objective deduction. And a subjective deduction has three elements. It's a doctrine of synthesis. That is a doctrine of how concepts get applied. That's one of the things that Kant means by synthesis, simply the application of concepts to intuitions. Secondly, it is a doctrine of what a synthesizer, let's call it a mind, must be like. What is it to be a synthesizer? And here the central notion is going to be the notion of unity. And finally, it is going to be a doctrine of the relation of the mind's awareness of itself to unity or to synthesis and to the application of concepts to objects. So it's going to gather those various elements together. And on my reading, I think both the A deduction and the B deduction have a similar structure in that they both occur in two parts. In the first part, Kant focuses on providing an account of the synthesis of given individual objects. I got a bottle before me. Let's talk about that for a minute. And then in the second part, and again, this is, I think, also in the B deduction, so I think the A deduction and the B deduction are the same structure, he moves from talking about awareness of individual objects and their perceptual manifold to talking about groups of objects and finally one global representation of one global object. So, moving to talk about the world as a whole. So the thought, or the underlying thought of the subjective deduction, which comes about a bit later in the deduction, is that for our experience, to have organized, unified objects. We need a rich ability to structure and organize our sensible stimuli. That we are, so to speak, the kind of beings who do things with our input, and that furthermore, we must synthesize things if we are going to be able to recognize them as synthesized. That is, we must put things together if we're going to recognize them as unified. So no unity without unification in the model. What's this, the opposite of? It's the opposite of association. I see red, I see round, you know, I see red and round lots of times. It's an apple. There is just, so on the empiricist story, we get the influx, right? And we simply have a recognition of the various bits, and we associate some bits with others, and we have regularities, but there's no activity of organizing or putting this together. Well, Tom says there are three cognitive abilities that are required to represent objects. Three minimal ones. He says apprehending, reproducing, and recognizing in a concept. Apprehending, reproducing, and recognizing. And therefore, this is going to be the three steps of this process. So he begins at A77 with what he says about synthesis, and then we'll talk about apprehension, reproduction, and recognition. By synthesis, in its most general sense, I understand the act of putting different representations together. Again, not sensations, not feelings, not raw anything. It's putting different representations together and of grasping what is manifold in them in one act of knowledge. So throughout, if I haven't made this obvious yet, this will become painfully so. Kant is, in this respect, a kind of Platonic philosopher, in that for him, the big question is always the one and the many. Over and over and over again. Manifold is just his word for the many. And he's always asking how the many are collected up into the one. Where the notion of one can be one mind, one act, one object, and all of these have to be interconnected. Right? That's the goal, is to show how the complexity, the manyness of the world, gets ordered and articulated into a certain type of unity. So we're looking at how the underlying acts of synthesis the underlying acts of the synthesis are apprehension, again, recognition and reproduction. Kant will argue that apprehension and reproduction must be had together, for reasons we'll come to, but that they can occur without recognition. So, the threefold synthesis. First, the synthesis of apprehension and intuition, that's A99. I won't read it all out, I'll just try to give an account of this stuff. The synthesis of apprehension is the recognition of a manifold as a manifold. That is, in broad terms, what this means is something like noting the brute spatial relatedness and temporal ordering, and hence the fact that each item as it affects our sensibility appears in a spatial relation to other items, in its parts in spatial relationship to one another, and in a temporal order before, after, with respect to other objects. So the thought here then is, very often, I don't know about you all, when I come up from the subway onto a place I know, but I don't know where, which corner I'm on, I have a tremendously vertiginous experience, right? I can't figure out where I am. Now, the not knowing where I am, in one sense, not exactly where I am, I'm on 23rd Street, but I can't figure out which corner, northeast, southwest. And so, here's the point. I can see that these objects are spatially related to one another, and I can see the cars coming after one another, but I can't figure out which is anything, right? So I have a manifold which has a spatial diversity to it, and it has a temporal complexity, and my vertiginousness, which in my case actually occasionally is something of an underlying nausea, I'm with you. I really find it unsettling in that moment. Because if somewhere you think you really know where you are, and you can't quite, right? It's not where you think you are. So I'm saying what happens here is, roughly, our other syntheses have collapsed, and we're back at the level of the synthesis of apprehension, where the manifold appears at manifold, but without any sense of firm recognition or order. Now, this cannot occur without reproduction, I'll come back to that. But the thought that lies behind this as an independent level is this. Why, if this cannot happen without reproduction, does Kant insist on it as an analytically distinct moment? makes a big deal. Had it suggested that whatever the origin of my representations, the very first sentence, whether they are due to the evils of outer things or produced through evils, whether they arise on blah, 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 they must all, as modifications of the mind, belong to inner sense. All our knowledge is thus finally subject to time, the formal condition of inner sense, let us all be ordered, connected, and brought into relation. This is the general observation which follows must be borne in mind as being quite fundamental. Every intuition contains in itself a manifold, which can be represented as a manifold only insofar as the mind distinguishes the time and the sequence of one impression upon another for each representation, insofar as it is contained in a single moment, can never be anything but absolute unity. So that I know, in this moment of vertiginousness, right? And what allows me to try to get my bearing is that I know there is a temporal order, that I'm looking from left to right. That's an ordered movement. Why insist on this moment of apprehension? Well, this is, I think, the answer to kind of what Ed was worried about with sensation. Only here, it has to enter at the cognitive level. And the answer is because without it, our synthesizing activities would lack a content. That is, this is the moment that deals with the givenness of the manifold, right? The reason I spoke of vertiginous is exactly my sense of not being in control of it. That I'm not manipulating where I am. On the contrary, I seem not only not to have control over it, I can't piece it together, right? And in that sense, this is my raw awareness of the world as not me already. The manifold, as spatio and temporally, right, distributed in ways outside my power, so that the synthesis of apprehension, which is a synthesis and an activity, I guess this is what Husserl will later call passive synthesis. I think this is exactly passive synthesis, in fact. So I'm registering this as a power and an activity, but it's a passive power. Right? A power of responsiveness and responding. So this is the moment in which we, as it were, take it. And I want to say we do take it. We take it that we are responding and that therefore that there is something that is given to which we are responding. So the notion of apprehension has about it, let's call it the claim of the world on our attention. That sensory sense that, you know, we're not just making this up whole cloth, but under constraint. And again, it's very hard to get a hold of this moment because it almost never again appears on its own. And it's why nominalists, you know, it's what nominalists forget, that we are responding to what's there. The notion of reproduction, and this gets articulated, by the way, later on in the critique, in sections of it that people never talk about, called the axioms of intuition and the anticipation of perception. And they correspond to what I'm calling here the synthesis of apprehension. Step two. I've not only got this awareness of the moment and of spatial diversity, but Kant says, mm. This idea has become so familiar through Derrida and Heidegger that it's hard to see that Kant got there first. Kant's thought is this. The argument is, theoretically, there can be no first without a second. That is, there can be no first moment of consciousness that is where we begin. And the reason why there can be no first moment of consciousness where we begin is because unless that moment is connected to a second moment, it would not count as first. Right? That our awareness of something as a first. And the example I like to give for those who have spent any time in London is listening to Big Ben, right? Bong, especially like midnight. Bong, bong. And of course, you often want to hear the first one, because you're counting madly. Now, the point here, and this is Kant's thought, is that in order for me to be counting the tones of Big Ben, I have to hold in mind the first, right? As I hear the second, and it's the holding in mind the first, the reproduction in imagination, that lets me hear the second, and finally, therefore, which goes back to the first, makes the first the first. So the idea here is that there cannot be a punctual present. The present is a relational term of what came before or after something else, because unless we connected, unless we held in mind the past, then each present would simply be a solitary thing. And that would be my vertiginousness gone wild. That would be like a scene out of Hitchcock where I come up and I'm dizzy and then I start spinning around and it all collapses, right? Because I can't connect it. I can't connect one moment with another. So, and I'm sure listening to my lectures is somewhat a bit like that, because you're waiting for the end of the sentence, right? So I start a sentence and there's going to be a complex series of logical clauses in which you're being asked to recognize the connections between the original premise, the conclusion, and how the inference got there. Got all that? Now, you see what's going on, though. When you're listening to the sentence, you are at each moment picking up, right, each word and carrying it along, an anticipation of where it's going. The anticipation of where it's going is recognition in the concept. So, come back to that in a second. So, the thought of reproduction as a strategy, stop here and come back. Start with this next week, though, is that we have a possibility of being aware of our experience as occurring through time, like the analogy, like listening to a sentence or a song or a piece of music, right? Where this becomes explicit.
And what happens there, say you're listening, think of listening to a complex piece of classical music. What are you holding in mind in order, in the final movement, when the theme comes back from the first movement? Imagine what you are collecting up in a unity, right, simply to hear that note. The identity of that note is dependent upon, so it as your now, right, is not now at all. Okay, we'll start there next week. We'll carry on doing deductions and judgments and things like that. Okay, since there's no one waiting outside, let's have a 7-8-10-minute break. And for those who wish, this is completely voluntary. If no one shows up, as I said, all the better for me. I just go home and eat cold Chinese food.